This is the MDT podcast.
A podcast for all healthcare professionals working with older adults. We are a multidisciplinary team educating about aging, MDT.
The MDT is brought to you by the Hearing Aid podcast team. We focus on a different topic each week to work with you to enhance your knowledge to help you look after older people. So just before we get into this episode, we wanted to tell you about a really exciting opportunity that we've got to come and work with us, or more specifically Ian, on the podcasts. So a clinical fellow for a year.
Yeah, working on the podcasts, some community simulation work that I do going out to care homes, and then working with our practice development team at East Surrey to embed the use of technology and technology-enhanced learning throughout the wards, ultimately with the aim of improving the care of older people throughout the hospital.
And they get to work for a day a week on the frailty unit in Redhill?
A day a week for whatever bits of the geriatric curriculum they need to cover. So
Excellent.
We can be flexible, yeah.
Great. And I've commuted to Redhill as a registrar. It is not that far out of London.
No, it's really close. It's a really nice hospital, really friendly people, really proactive. Closing date, though, is the 17th of April, so you've not got long.
Really soon. So apply. It's on NHS Jobs. If you're interested or you've got any more questions, then contact us on Twitter.
Welcome to this fifth episode of the seventh series of the MDT. My name is Ian Wilkinson. I'm a consultant geriatrician down in Redhill in Surrey. And this is...
I'm Jo Preston. I'm a geriatrician at St George's in South London.
And we've got two other people with us in the studio today. So we'll introduce them now.
I'm Alison Fitzgerald. I'm the lead nurse for the OPAR team at St George's.
Hello, Alison.
And I'm Sarah Smith. I'm the lead therapist for the team that work in A&E at St George's.
Perfect. Hello, Sarah. And the other faculty member on this episode was Tracy CK. And today we're going to do an episode on front door frailty and interface geriatrics, something that we sort of hinted at a few times but never quite got around to actually discussing. So coming up this week, we're going to understand and have a think about the way that front door teams manage patients with frailty. We're going to hopefully be able to recognise when a front door frailty or an interface geriatric team might be helpful, and have a think about what it might be a bit like to work alongside a front door frailty team.
But first,
social media. Jo, this week, what have you got?
This week I've got an article that I saw was published recently, and it is Frailty as a Moderator of Alzheimer's Disease Pathology and Dementia, which is really interesting. Did you see this?
I have not seen
it. I think it was published in Lancet or Nature or something like one of those very good journals, essentially. And what they did is that they looked at the link between the pathology they find on postmortems for people with Alzheimer's dementia and people who clinically express dementia. And what they've previously found is there hasn't been a clear correlation. So what they did is a cohort study, and they did frailty scoring, and they looked at lots of different demographics. And when they controlled for those, they found that frailty was the thing that was most likely to influence whether you expressed dementia from the pathological changes they found, which I thought was really interesting.
That's interesting. And that sort of goes along with that stuff we talked about before, about frailty being a reduction in your ability to withstand another stressor of some description, and maybe the Alzheimer's pathology is another stressor, and actually if you're frail you just can't cope with that.
Yeah, so I think it's quite interesting because there's quite a lot of talk about, you know, what is frailty and what's the use of recognising it and things like that. So to see something quite pathophysiological, actually it changes the expression of pathology, I think is really interesting, something we'll probably hear a lot more about over the next sort of decade or so. So yeah, I thought it was really interesting.
Cool.
Yeah.
So my one, so when we record these, we write what we're going to talk about a little while beforehand. So it's just possible that when today I was looking at Twitter to bring something to do this episode, I didn't actually remember what episode we were doing. So I have found something that actually is perfect, and it's completely coincidental.
I was wondering where you were going.
Yeah. So this is a tweet from Martin Vernon, and it's talking about a blog article on the NHS England webpage by a GP in Shropshire. And it is about the Frailty Intervention Team, which is a front door frailty team in Shrewsbury and Telford. And it was just really good. And it was just a nice description about what you can do from one small little office and just getting the right people together to talk to each other. And it was just really good. But and then I sort of, I did that, and then I started to get ready, and I was like, oh, we're doing front door frailty.
Oh, today.
Oh, yes, I knew it. You know, done a bit of reading about that recently. That's why. Let's get back to business. So front door frailty, Joe.
So front door geriatrics or front door frailty can mean different things in different localities. Generally speaking, they're talking about multidisciplinary teams that are specialising in the care of older adults, working in settings such as the emergency department, the CDU, on AMUs, or sometimes on frailty units as well. And we're going to talk a little bit through different models that are out there.
Taking what we know works, which is a multidisciplinary team to look after an older person, to deliver CGA.
Which is usually ward-based,
and it's just moving it a bit sooner in the pathway.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, so part of the rationale for this is that attendances to emergency departments are increasingly characterised not by life-threatening medical emergencies, which is kind of what they were sort of 20, 30 years ago, but by non-emergency situations. So, for example, relapses and their chronic conditions, and the consequences of a fall, a breakdown in their social care or functional difficulties, including a decrease in mobility. And safe discharges back to the community often require assessment of needs and setting up of support systems in addition to treating any medical symptoms that they're presenting with, which is something that we see quite often, isn't it?
Very regularly, really. It's all the vast majority of older people that come that do present in this way, with this multitude of facets, really, that you need to be looking at. And so that totally underlines the need for the MDT.
Yeah. And recognition of that shift in focus, the BGS in 2012 put together the Silver Book, which is a guide to the first 24 hours of urgent care for older adults. And that's not necessarily focused on the hospital. It can be at any urgent settings. It might be in the community. But that's kind of quite a while ago now. So I think it's probably due an upgrade.
Yeah, it does for quite a long time. I think there are plans afoot. And I guess on the back of that also, the BGS then went on and set up a frailty in urgent care specialist interest group in 2017 that I'm sure they'd be happy for everyone to, that's BGS members, to go and join.
And they've started doing conferences as well, haven't they? You guys have been to some.
We just had in February,
yeah.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
It's just been how I think they're annually, aren't they, at the moment, yes. The specific kind of joint urgent care conference. But yeah, they've been really, really positive and we've been...
Yeah, very well attended and very interesting hearing it coming from both sides.
Having kind of acute fissures in the room, I guess, listening to, you know, say that kind of...
Getting more interested
interested in it and I guess, accepting that is a lot of their core business now, so they need to be able to, you know... manage. And
I think that's, as you say, part of it is accepting that rather than fighting that.
Absolutely.
Which I think in recent years feels like the shift that has allowed this kind of to happen. The people saying, actually, we do need help. This is something that's different and it's not going away. It's not going to change. We need to find a way to work with it. So that's quite good.
And I think it's recognising that multi-professional intervention is absolutely key and getting that as early in the patient journey as possible. And if you can get it early enough, you may actually be able to increase your 0-day admissions. You know, your people that you turn around within 24 hours.
And absolutely, I think it helps you focus in on the right people to maybe achieve that as well, because there's some who have very clearly are going to need to stay. But if you can focus on the ones that maybe you can do that with, if you get that whole MDD approach, then that's going to help not only those ones, but also the people that need to stay.
Yeah. And I think a big bit of that is us doctors accepting that we can't make that decision alone, and also, you know, the nurses and the therapists and everyone actually going, we all have a little bit of this jigsaw and we can see what our bit looks like, but we don't necessarily know what the rest of the bit looks like, and we have to, you know, get everyone together and assess patients early, swiftly, in a detailed manner to see the whole picture.
And I think traditionally it's been seen as kind of a medical decision. It's a, what's the medical issue? There's no medical issue here. Or yes, they're fine to go. Why can't they just go? And I think it's really switching from that, looking at that broader MDT approach much earlier on to try and recognise those issues, and rather than, you know, just waiting for if they get complex, like, oh, actually, we've treated their pneumonia and actually we've just realised all of these things now. It's getting a lot of that sorted. So even for those people that need to come in...
Yeah, it's about working in tandem, isn't it? So that you're not doing one plan and then getting thwarted because you haven't thought of another bit. So actually, if you all do it together, that...
In parallel,
much better,
isn't it?
Yes.
Rather than sequential and kind of waiting for this to this, isn't it, till you start. It's parallel working.
And I think that fits in with the episode we did...
On flow.
A couple of weeks ago on flow, where we talked very much about sort of parallel working and getting people through the system.
And what are those components that contribute? And this is one of those, isn't it?
Definitely.
So front door frailty teams are generally multidisciplinary teams that are similar, as Ian said, to those that you would find on a normal ward, but kind of trying to recreate that in different settings and work out what the right combination and approach of those are. So it's getting involved much earlier in the admission, and there are a few different aims to that, really. So one would be to implement early CGA and identify any issues that need to be addressed.
So one thing could be to identify which need hospital management, which patients that is.
And we're going to touch on that in a couple of weeks' time, where we talk about to admit or not to admit with people that have had falls.
And also identify which of those issues that need hospital management and or can be sorted in the community.
And then also identifying which community services need to be involved in terms of longer-term issues to be addressed with those patients, and highlighting those and ensuring they're on board so that there's a not only the MDT within the hospital but also within the community as well.
Proactively identifying those things that are going to keep them well
Absolutely,
in the longer term.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then recognising those patients that are clearly going to need a longer inpatient stay on a medicine for the elderly specialist ward, and actually identifying that up front and getting them triaged to the right ward.
Maintaining mobility and function through early intervention. So probably talk a bit more about it later, isn't it? But there's quite a lot of evidence out there that suggests that obviously the earlier you get a therapy assessment, the better in terms of length of stay, but also patient outcomes in terms of function and maintaining, you know, their independence and being in a better place, I guess, for discharge when that time comes.
And then through all of these, really using those to prevent further admissions in the future. Yeah. So set up a decent care plan that is robust and will work going forwards in the next, you know, hours, days, weeks, months. And I think one of the things that's going to help drive this is the advent of the acute medical unit, ambulatory units that hospitals are setting up. And I know, for example, where I am, you know, we set one up a year ago, and it now takes about a third of our acute take goes through our ambulatory unit. And once you've got systems set up like that, actually you have a whole wealth of different ways of managing people, you know, because you can bring someone back tomorrow to check how they are, or 2 days' time, or a week's time, or all of those, you know. So actually you're it's not just discharging someone out into the community and relying on the GP and the community services to pick things up expediently, which you can't necessarily rely on. You don't know when that's going
to
happen. It's being able to support that yourself.
Yeah. It's also about managing expectations early for complex and frail older adults. So things like setting management plans, looking at what their rehabilitation goals might be, where they might be discharged to and with that needs, planning earlier on in the admission, and also looking at ceilings of treatment if that's appropriate as well, and recognising that early on. Trying to identify which issues need to be addressed during that admission versus the ones that need to be managed at home.
Yes, acute, or ones that you don't have to deal with this moment. I think that's very crucial, because people can get caught up in the wrong element, and that leads to people staying that maybe don't need to.
Yeah.
I think that is one of the problems with CGA as well, is that we generate a problem list and you find all these things and you think, well, I've got to manage this, I've got to fix this. Like, what? Not necessarily now.
Yeah.
You know, it's not necessarily an acute problem. It was there a few days ago. It's probably still going to be there in a few days' time. But
I think it's, you know, having the skills to recognise that, isn't it? That you get these people and you think, I could open a whole can of worms here, or I could probably just, you know, you could, well, not essentially, but I guess always recognise those things. But then, like, it's a signpost on or refer on to the appropriate services to look at them in more detail, isn't it? But actually, let's say right there, right now, in A&E, you know, probably doesn't need to be, you know.
I think that's what's been really beneficial about having the acute frame of mind on that, the community frame of mind on that. And at that, I'm looking at Sarah because she's been doing lots of acute medicine work for a little while now. And Alison, you've done community work in the past. Whereas geriatricians traditionally would have been like, well, I have to deal with all this myself and bring it in. Yes. So actually bringing those three things together, I think, is what makes something like this work,
definitely,
isn't it?
Definitely. And I think it's crucial in terms of its success, really, that you have those elements, or you don't actually, you're going to miss something.
Yeah. Oh, you're not going to have the confidence about where you can manage that.
Yes, exactly.
And also advanced care planning, just going
absolutely.
Like in,
I think that's hugely important. And just going back a bit to your ceilings of care as well, I think that if you see people early on, you can have those discussions and have realistic expectations both from the patient and potentially family and relatives, which if they don't happen, and they may leave thinking, oh, great, they're treating the chest infection, that's fantastic. And then when somebody is trying to tell them that actually maybe this isn't going to work, it's a huge shock. But if you've had those discussions early on, people are a little bit prepared for things,
what may happen,
yeah. Exactly.
So can I play devil's advocate? I don't think the front door is the place to be doing a care plan, acute care planning. The front door is the place to be doing advanced care planning. I think we should be doing this, and we as a society, we have to decide and have to realise
that we have to do this.
We have to get our head around that.
We have to do this.
Two, three years before this.
No, I totally agree. I think the problem at the moment is it doesn't happen, so that is what needs to happen. Mm. But going forward, absolutely. Yeah, it needs to be brought much further ahead.
It's the thing we have to do, but I don't think it's a fair thing to do when... You know, everything's all over the place. It's all topsy-turvy.
Absolutely.
And you're going, right, now, at this point, let's talk about... Yeah. You know.
But you quite often see...
I was just going to say, I think it's about... There are some cases where you have no option but to do that at that moment in time. Mm. And others, again, like we were saying before, you can leave and you can refer to the palliative care team in the community or whatever to deal with going forward. But unfortunately, there are quite a number of people that just appear that you need to have those discussions with.
About it, but haven't necessarily had that conversation, or they haven't been in that situation where it's been real, so they haven't needed to deal with it.
Yes.
I think there's a project going on with the Royal College of Physicians at the moment with palliative care about second conversations. I know that we had an SHO who was dealing with that, and I think this kind of helps with that. You can start that conversation, and then you can go back to it and have that second conversation. Where if you're having that first one later on in the admission, that's much harder time, isn't it? Mm. And I think that when people first come in, also obviously this is the way that we run it at St George's, is that you're there kind of finding out more about them, finding out about what they're like usually, and that's quite a natural then extension into the conversations of what would you like and what, you know, those kinds of things. Whereas I find that difficult on the acute medical take. I'm coming with my very medic hat rather than my geriatrician hat, and I'm meeting like 40 people in a day, and it's really difficult to have that conversation. But I think it's a slightly different focus and a slightly different frame in which you're having it. I think that's
very true, because we are coming at it from a different angle, and we're not got the whole of the acute medicine unit to get round and sort out. We've got a specific cohort from there, which does make a difference. Yeah.
So for any good front door service to work, there really needs to be access to information regarding the person's normal circumstances, what their care provision is, what their normal support network is. And doing that earlier on is usually quite helpful, because relatives are more likely to be around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can get like an accurate collateral and be realistic about what you're trying to do early on.
They might come with a carer from the home, that kind of thing, and then they disappear.
It's really important to have access to community documentation and information systems. And we did an episode on community that Alison helped us with before. Around some of this, and that's something that you found quite helpful coming from the community, wasn't it? You were able to tap into all of that.
Definitely. And I think what's, you know, going forward, the other thing that we need to, we get all this information, and we don't want to have to constantly repeat getting all this information. So it's about making sure that it's documented somewhere that everybody can access it. So if the person does arrive at the hospital again, they've got a much better understanding of that person from the minute they arrive, rather than all reinventing the wheel.
And I think just picking up on that, there's a really good, if you happen to be the person that's there when the relatives are there, then you're the person that now has to get that information, you know. Yes. And it doesn't matter who you are, whether or not you're the doctor or one of the nurses or a therapist or, you know, anyone. It's, we all work together, and you have this golden opportunity to get that information. Yes. And that may go, as you said, Sarah, that, you know, the relatives, they may go, you know, but they will go eventually, you know, and then you've lost that opportunity for another 24 hours, and then you've got to then fashion that opportunity, which is much harder to do than just sort of opportunistically do it at the time.
I think sadly it doesn't happen as much as we'd like in that way, isn't it? And I agree, like, absolutely. I think we're certainly trying to drive that more at St George at the moment, isn't, with our electronic notes that we've sort of now introduced, and trying to, I suppose, sort of really encourage that it's everyone's part, you know. Particularly for this cohort, like we're talking about, and, you know, but unfortunately, I think, particularly in ED, I guess, and I can understand it, you know, but for me, it's always back to your clinical reasoning, your decision making, isn't it, for anyone? And, like, really, that's a huge part of it, isn't it? And so, yeah, I agree. I think we really, really need to be driving that as a priority.
I've often thought, going back to your flow article, some of the lean processing stuff that Toyota did, and then they applied to stroke thrombolysis, and they said, right, what are the components that we need to do this quickly and effectively to make a decision? Mm. And one of the rate limiting things that they found was knowing that person's background. Mm. When did this start? Mm-hmm. Because thrombolysis is quite time sensitive. When did it start? What they normally like to make that decision? It's one of the biggest influences. And so they assigned that specifically as a job for one person. And so I think they called them like an enhanced social worker or something. They weren't an actual like social worker, but their job, their role was to go and take that piece of the history. And I've quite often thought that would be just a great role to just have everyone coming into ED. Necessarily clinically, but they're clinically trained to go do that, and then that would save so much time.
100%.
And inform clinical decision making, as you say.
There's been some research like about collateral histories and like kind of the impact on that and length of stay and things, and particularly patients with delirium and things, and it always shows that it absolutely improves outcomes and length of stay.
Of course it does, yeah.
But it's only completed in like a tiny percentage of the amount of patients that are there with delirium. So it's
there's a nice acronym for taking collateral histories, isn't there, Jo?
Maple.
And looking at the use of maple. And we'll put an image of the maple collateral history bit into the show notes. And you can go and have a look.
Because it's quite nice. It's really good, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. So, as I said, we're going to talk a little bit more about sort of the team structure and models and things like that. So the teams, as we said, usually involve doctors, nurses, physiotherapists, OTs, can involve pharmacists, social workers. And as we said, given the setting that they work in, they require skills in both acute medicine and in geriatrics, and quite often will work more across disciplinary boundaries than in other traditional roles.
With a sort of blurring of the boundaries and working in that liminal space between different therapies.
I think it's probably how I think that's maybe why the BGS and the Society of Acute Medicine have started the kind of taking AHPs and nurses on board in their, in their societies, if you know what I mean, rather than us having our separate therapy kind of,
Well, that's the whole point of this podcast, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's to learn out of their silos.
And that's how the STAR team work predominantly, isn't it?
Absolutely. We kind of work in a sort of extended role. The STAR team is basically physiotherapists and occupational therapists and some rehab assistants. We work just at the front door in A&E, but also in the acute medical unit. And we very much kind of, I suppose, responded to the population really and the need in that environment, which is very fast paced, obviously. So quite often, our patients will only see one of either a physio or an OT. And that's quite common now in their kind of front door therapy teams. And we kind of developed, I suppose, competencies alongside the Society of Acute Medicine that look at, how you work like that and how you learn those skills and develop. I mean, it does mean, I guess, that most of those teams are quite senior heavy because you are, I guess, making those quick decisions and you are having to work outside of your traditional model, and that can take time to develop, isn't it, when you're still learning your own, kind of profession, if you like. But I guess with good reason, but we do have band fives and juniors in the teams now, and it does, is working really well. And I think that's certainly the future, but that's how it works.
Yes, that's true. Within the OPA team, we the same. There is a sort of blurring of boundaries. Although it's in our particular team, it's doctors and nurses. We have had with some therapy input. At the moment, we use the STAR team, but we all feel able because of our past experience and as you say, the competencies to start various things, and we not wait for a physio to do something or wait for an OT to do something. We would feel competent to do to a certain level. Clearly there are some areas you definitely would want a physio or an OT, but it doesn't mean that people end up having to sit and wait for that to happen.
You have those people around can be quite flexible.
So
two of the main models we're going to talk about, probably the only two real models that there are liaison into acute areas, which is kind of what we've been talking about. And we'll talk about a little bit more about that next, and then a bit about bedded frailty units, because there's quite a lot of noise about bedded frailty units and which one's the right one and whether we should have frailty units or not. And there really isn't a clear evidence base for which one you should use?
Not yet.
Not yet. But you went to one of the recent conferences. You were saying there's some studies going on
Yeah, exactly. The joint BGS and SAM urgent care conference, wasn't it? And yeah, there was, yeah.
And also the NHS benchmarking as
well.
Yeah,
the benchmarking,
they were also
yeah.
talking about it.
Exactly. So the information, certainly the data, I guess, is being gathered, because it's all relatively new, isn't it? All the developments sort of last 5 years or so. So I think, just starting to get now proper data sets to be able to create that research, isn't it? But I think it's coming. It's in the pipeline, isn't it? It'll be really interesting to see.
Yeah.
At the moment, it seems just really, really kind of what I guess is realistic in your area, isn't it? In terms of the space and kind of physical space.
The key thing, isn't it? It's what the needs are of your
demographic
and the, what you have available.
And the environment you've got to work
builds.
In and all those sorts of things.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So we're just going to talk about the key features of each one and then talk a little bit more about some of the evidence base that has come. I found a nice paper on from 2018 that was looking at American models, so slightly bear that in mind when we're talking about it. But so liaison to acute areas, generally it's joint care, or they remain under their admitting team and then you're contributing to their care. So these tend to have less traditional structures, more interdisciplinary working that can be a bit more flexible.
Yeah, and I think also the other element of it is that, certainly from our experience, is that the learning that takes place amongst staff within the acute medicine unit, just kind of by osmosis almost, because you're doing things and they see things being done, they begin to start picking those things up, which I think is a very positive thing.
Really, really positive,
I guess the thing is making sure that the team that's doing the liaising, so that the frailty team, if you like, are able to put the input into those patients.
Yes.
You know, because if you've got an AMU that's got 40 beds and 35 of them need to be seen by the frailty team, you're not going to get the outcomes that you want. So you need to staff the team in such a way that actually they can put the additional in for the added benefit, which is what you're after.
Yes, exactly. And I think it's also very important that, I mean, although the term liaison is used, it isn't just verbal liaising, it's actually getting in there and doing things with people and hands-on, because otherwise I'd think that would be quite difficult. And you're just seen
it's
as
just
someone
an opinion, then,
yes.
And so acute areas, as we say, can be ED or CDU, where it's quite common to have therapists in those areas, but not so much necessarily the geriatric teams, although increasingly so going into those areas. It can be on an AMU, but it also can be pre-hospital. So combining that skill mix when people are unwell at home and seeing if you can support them at home as well.
I think if I'm right, that's how the one of the quite well-known systems is based in Leicester. Mm. And I think that's how the Leicester system started. And then they actually took over the CDU and developed a bedded frailty area.
Yes, they did, which I think is where all of the ideas for frailty units have come from. And I think that that's it's quite important to bear in mind where they came from and how they did that. So embedded frailty units, the patients will more likely to be owned by the team and have more traditional team structures. There are usually clear pathways for preventing unnecessary admission and work out best generally when they're integrated well with social services. So hospitals that sit across multiple councils and CCGs might not work so well. So
certainly in the area that we work, there's, you know, without even trying, you can think of six different boroughs. So they've all got different rules, they've all got different teams. Yeah. So that would certainly, it's more of an issue.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things in the flow episode. We talked about the fact that most strategies to improve patient flow have focused on acute hospitals or community care or something else. There's very few that have done what the vanguards are trying to do and look at a whole health and social care system, if you like.
Yeah.
And that's exactly where this sort of comes in, is that you have to have those working relationships with the services before and after you to get the patient through your pathway. It's fine, you're assessing and working out that they can go home and they do all this, but actually if the social care side of things can't pick up that stuff that needs picking up, then that whole pathway falls apart.
I think that's the risk, is that without that, they can just become more beds.
Yeah.
And without that pathway element that is facilitated through the frailty unit itself, it will just create more beds rather than helping.
Keep the flow through it.
Yeah. And I think the other thing to bear in mind with bedded frailty units is that they generally have quite well-defined criteria for admission, which means that people who don't meet that criteria but might still benefit from the service may not get there. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I'm sounding quite down on frailty units. I'm not. I just think they have been cited as sort of the solution to everything. And I think it's about more than that. It's about that flow. It's about thinking what the skill mix is and the pathway is to make it work. And
so I guess there's also, like, where we work, we've got our Pendleton unit, which is like a day assessment unit, if you like. So it pulls people at risk from the community up for a multi-professional assessment with the aim of trying to reduce admissions that way, as well as pulling people from the emergency department.
Who can be ambulated.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think you've got that two sides to that process, actually. There's an opportunity pre-hospital as well to stop somebody coming to the front door when you don't want them to.
Yeah.
You know,
and then because that's the only way to get access to the MDT, and I think that's something to really think about.
There's been some great pilots with kind of therapists and things on the paramedics and the ambulances and things that have shown real, you know, similar thing, real benefits to actually stopping them get there in the first place.
Yeah. A few years ago, I was involved with something called the Who Knows Best study, which was looking at, in inverted commas, inappropriate, close inverted commas, admissions to hospital. And it was a really nice study, based from the guys at the university in Birmingham. But one of the big outcomes for that is at the point of acute admission for all these patients that that were involved in the interviews, hospital was the only place they could go at that point, actually. And all the interventions to stop going to hospital actually could have been done, but needed to be shifted back. Yeah. And actually, and frailty units are one of the ways of trying to do that and flagging people up who are more at risk and doing something about it earlier.
I think the paramedics are maybe sort of like a quite unsung hero, isn't it? That we're
missing.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we did a really small quality improvement project a little while ago, but part of that was we asked the ambulance crew when they brought them in, why they brought them in, you know, what sort of was the reasoning, and just not in a, you know, why have you brought them
what
in way,
doing?
But, you know, to understand again their reasoning and stuff. And lots of them said that they were kind of, well, there's lots of reasons, but lots of them said that they felt still quite restricted by their sort of paramedic manual, which seems quite out of date, to be honest with you, and is quite, I suppose,
emergency focused?
Yeah, and very much has like a, you know, have they got chest pain, bring in kind of thing, you know, like very dictative, whereas lots of them obviously have those skills and reasoning and experience to actually look at a bigger picture, isn't it? And so lots of them felt like they were just still quite obliged or had to, isn't it? Or patients wanted to was another reason, and didn't feel that they would have the backup then. But yeah, I think they're really a huge resource that, you know, could really
support.
Yeah, make some changes. You know?
So we've talked about what the kind of clinical focus is for front door frailty, and the focus is really on good early quality care for older adults, but inevitably system metrics creep in and are of interest to managers and are things that we're kind of put up against sometimes. So I just thought we might talk through some of those, because I think they're not quite as straightforward as they sound quite often. So quite often it's stated that these models can decrease length of stay through preventing avoidable admissions. But we need to always balance that against readmissions rates and make sure we're not just discharging people and getting them out so they've got a really short length of stay, but actually they come back again 3 days later. And so that's a really good, I think, quality balance measure for that you should measure in any service. Decreased early length of stay can lead to increased length of stay in your downstream wards, but hopefully in less people.
So that means if you send a lot of people home in the first couple of days, your average length of stay may go up, because the people that are left are the people that are staying longer.
The people that are coming in and the people that really need to come in, and there's no other way to manage them. Bearing that in mind, though, if you don't have your bed base right, if you already have, you know, 20 people on other wards that could be looked after in your senior health wards, they'll just get pulled in. So actually it's not you're going to get a dilution, and so you may not see that as well. But also as a function of getting that information early, you might see a decreased length of stay in the downstream wards because of that information that's been gathered earlier. So it might lead to a decrease in your stranded patients that you're seeing. So there's different kind of stop points that you could look at this. But it's quite messy to get the data. So just conscious when people try and hold you against it, you shouldn't.
I think the key thing with all the things data is it's more measuring the change and sort of you know, having a baseline, doing whatever it is that you're doing, and then seeing what the change from that baseline is, and just
like
really thinking about it. It is, yeah. It's all you need. You need an SPC chart, basically. If you don't know what an SPC chart is, there's a really good Scottish improvement website that goes through SPC charts in just sort of nice, simple language, going, this is what this shows, and this is what, you know, good looks like, and this is what not good looks like. It's really good.
So there is one paper that I talked about earlier, which is called Acute Care for Elders Team Model of Care, a Clinical Overview, which was published last year. So Acute Care for Elders is ACE. So it's quite a common acronym that we hear. So Croydon have an ACE team. This is a term that it seems is used quite a lot in the States. This is a paper that looks at the two different types of care, so liaison models and frailty units, and looking at some randomised control trials that have been done in those. So they are in America, so it's a different system of care. But it describes things quite nicely. So it says, the ACE unit model consists of several core components. One is patient-centred care with proactive geriatric assessments. Two, nurse-driven care plans for prevention and management of geriatric syndromes. Third is comprehensive care transition planning, beginning at admission. And fourthly, medical care review with the goal to prevent iatrogenesis and incident geriatric syndromes. That's kind of what we've been talking about, but just condensed really nicely. So that's quite good. And that care is delivered by an interprofessional team that usually conducts frequent team meetings, usually Monday to Friday, but obviously we're trying to go to 7-day working. So interestingly, the first randomised control trial of an ACE unit was done in 1995, which is quite a long time ago, isn't it? I wouldn't have thought it was that long ago. And that did demonstrate benefits of care delivery in that design. So they did a systematic review. They found sort of 600 records, but actually only 22 studies that they could include. And as I said, they categorised those in two different types of ACE models. So one was ACE units and one was ACE services, which is kind of the liaison. In looking at the ACE units, there are a couple of randomised control trials, and both of them found significantly increased documentation of geriatric syndromes in the patients that presented to the ACE unit compared to usual care units or urgent care units. So that was taking people with, I think it was over 65, or it was an age cutoff anyway, rather than frailty, and just saying, okay, what happens in these two different circumstances? They found significantly increased use of nurse-driven geriatric care protocols, earlier and more frequent consultations with social work and physical therapy. Then they go on to describe a different type of unit, which I thought was quite interesting, called the ACE Tracker Programme, which summarises in one report the geriatric data items documented by the various ACE team members. So if someone wrote down a history of cognitive impairment, the results of geriatric screens, presence of potentially inappropriate medications, talking to social services or rehabilitation and therapies, that would all be pulled together. Mm-hmm. That was then used by an e-geriatrician, which I really like the sound of, who could participate in the unit's ACE rounds using a telephone conference call, using the same electronic tracker data. Looking at a pre and post study of those care processes, this is the e-geriatrician, which I still, it's like they're virtual, they're not real. The e-geriatrician model demonstrated significant reduction in the use of urinary catheters, an increase in consultation from physical therapists on both surgical and medical units, but didn't have much of a change on other processes and measures like use of physical restraints, social service assessments and high-risk medications. So not quite as good for using that kind of bedded model. And they also had a virtual ACE as well, where they didn't have a geriatrician that was present, but everyone was, all of the team members that were there were trained in ACE principles, so using the care protocols, screening for delirium and all those kinds of things. So they're more likely to participate in those things, but not necessarily have the other increased outcomes.
So how about the liaison services?
So, liaison services, which they named MACE, so a mobile ACE, I really like a good acronym, they call this delivering geriatric care without the limitations of a physical unit. So the model consisted of geriatricians, sometimes with a more junior geriatric doctor as well, a social worker, a clinical nurse specialist assigned to the hospital rather than to the unit. And they would do daily meetings and try and address the geriatric care needs that they'd identified, and do early care transition planning is what they called it.
So that's interesting, isn't it? Because that's like the original work on mobile CGAs or non-ward-based CGA, which for delivering CGA did not work.
So this showed that this model did significantly reduce adverse events and length of stay and showed an increase in care transition preparedness, which I think was a questionnaire they did with patients and families. Both of the studies they looked at looked at intensive geriatric education experience delivered to the general medical team. So as we say, that kind of learning within the team and upskilling the rest of the team, coupled with the implementation of the care processes, was the thing that really helped. So there's kind of pluses and negatives to both, and obviously there were lots of different studies in there, but most of them did show that both models were of benefit, whichever way that you want to do it. So one's not superior over the other. I think units have been studied more, and I think they are easier to study. So we'll wait and see what happens from the outcome of that other evaluation that's happening at the moment.
So that's everything we wanted to talk about. If you've got any thoughts on front door or interface geriatric services and frailty services, then please do let us know. You can contact us via Twitter
at MDT_podcast
or on facebook.com/MDT podcast
or on our website www.thehearingaidpodcast.org.uk.
And on the website you can sign up to our mailing list, where you will get a monthly email from us talking about what we've been up to, with the infographics on and occasionally a few additional extra little bits. You can log your learning via the CPD logger, and you can see all the show notes for the references and everything. They're downloadable. The infographics are there.
All the references and things that we talk about.
Yeah, and the mapping for the curriculums. So if you're a foundation doctor or a CMT doctor or a GP trainee or a high specialist trainee in geriatrics,
advanced nurse practitioner,
or a physician associate, they're all mapped to your curriculums. And if you generally work in the NHS, they're also mapped to the NHS Knowledge Skill Framework. So you can reflect on them and link them into any of your portfolios and things. Over the next week, on Twitter, using the hashtag MDTClub, Dan Thomas will be collating a Twitter chat or a tweet chat about some of the things we've talked about in this episode. So please interact with that and drop us a line through that and let us know what your thoughts are.
The MDT Podcast.
But before that, now it's time for the MDT teaser. This is our catchily titled MDT item guessing game that is basically like the TV classic catchphrase, but the faculty have asked us to do it on the radio.
Which is great.
And I think we're going to change that at the end of this series. So if you've got an idea of a way to do a different quiz, then please do let us know. So
Shall I go first? Yeah, you go first.
Okay.
While I find
one. Okay, so I was quite pleased by this one. There is a cup of water on a table. There is also a pole on the table. The pole is held up and is measured. It's then put into the water, comes out of the water, and it is remeasured, and it is the same size, as you would expect. Then something is added to the water, the pole is put into the water, and it comes out, and the diameter of the pole has increased. And the arrow points to the item that was put into the water. That is what I want you to guess.
Oh, my God.
It's made the distance, the width of the pole, increase.
Oh.
You've all gone, but no one said anything.
Is it to do with the thickening fluid?
Yes. Yes, it's thickener.
What's the pole that's doing anything?
Yeah. I needed something to change in size.
The fluid
changed the pole thickness.
Yes. It's a thickener.
It's a loose one, I've got to be
honest.
But we got there.
I'm glad you said it, yeah. Okay. It's my turn. So Alison and Sarah helped me come up with this one, so you have to guess it yourself.
Okay. So it's better than usual, then.
Excuse me. Okay, so this is...
It does feel a bit like three against one.
So this is hanging on a wall inside...
99 green bottles.
Four wooden pieces of wood.
98 green bottles.
Inside there is a pitcher.
Okay.
And the pitcher is of the outside of a house. And on the outside of the house there is a black sort of tubing which is running along the outside of the house.
Is it a gutter frame?
It's a gutter frame, yes.
Too easy.
Cool.
I don't want any complaints. I get a lot of complaints about mine. So, you know.
So if you want to have a go, well, there's a pictorial version of that, which is more usual, pinned to our Twitter feed.
Yes.
And you can have a guess using the hashtag MDteaser. And you can win a mug. Who would like it? Yeah, mugs are the good mugs, I have to say. Yeah. We also have some pens.
We have pens, yes.
It's like gold.
Need to give you both a pen.
Oh, my God, I'd love a pen.
Oh, yes. We have some MDT pens.
I'll give you pens tomorrow.
And if you come to the autumn BGS meeting in Leicester in November, we will have some pens for you there too. So the gallery is our final thing. If you have anything that you want to contribute to the gallery, so a poem or a passage of a book or a short piece of music or something, then please do let us know and we'll include it. Jo, you've brought this one.
I have, yes. So this is a book, which is a graphic novel, but less in the style of pure cartoon, but more sort of written with lots of pictures going through it. And it's called Can We Talk About Something More Pleasant? So I just thought I'd read the kind of sleeve of it. It's by a New Yorker cartoonist called Roz Chast about her parents in their final years. Her parents were practitioners of denial. If you don't ever think about death, then it will never happen. Can we talk about something more pleasant as the story of an only child watching her parents age well into their 90s and die? A long-time New Yorker cartoonist, she combines drawings with family photos and documents chronicling the long goodbye, and that, however expected, always seems to come as a surprise. That's quite a nice book.
Mm. Sounds cool. Sounds sad, but
cool. Yeah. I think it isn't as sad as it sounds. Like, it is, but because she's quite a good cartoonist, she's done it with quite a nice level of sort of humour. And
came across some resources this week, actually, along that lines. You can buy them as a pack of cards, or there's a web page that like deals out cards, and the idea is you sort of deal them out, and you just they've got a topic to discuss, and then you put it into most important to me or slightly less important, and then you can move them all around and everything, and then on the web page you can print it all out.
Okay,
that's really quite cool. As like an advanced care planning discussion document.
Well, that's it from us this time. The MDT will reconvene in 2 weeks' time.
Dr. Wilkinson has previously received funding from Astellas and UCB Pharmaceuticals for delivering educational activities. The MDT podcast is a hearing aid podcast's Big Things Media production. Additional music by Kevin MacLeod. This podcast has been made possible from a technology-enhanced learning grant from Health Education England, spreading education throughout Kent, Surrey and Sussex. For more information, visit thehearingaidpodcasts.org.uk.